What if we could reimagine the traditional notion of a high flyer? Hey friends, welcome back, or welcome to the High Flyers podcast. For the curious ones, where we share diverse experiences in life, not just work, tune in and learn to fly high in your own way, from value creators and problem solvers at all aspects of society. Learn about their sunrise, magic moments, hustle, and so much more to help us all be 1% better every day together. And I'm your host, Vidit Agarwal.
That's what it took in order to have a successful business for a long period of time. You really have to be passionate about what you're choosing to do. So whilst I had always had it in the back of my mind that I would love to do, I'd love to see if I could start my own business and do something and challenge myself in that way, I never could see anything that I was passionate about enough to do. And I spoke about finding my why. That really was the catalyst for everything else that followed, because I found it, and at the same time I'd been reading a book, or working through a book called The Artist Way, by Julia Cameron.
That's Chloe Temple, and this is episode 46. I've known Chloe for some time now, and always enjoyed our conversations, so I'm glad she did this conversation on the record. Chloe talks about growing up in the UK in a small, tight-knit family, looking up to her parents, with her dad being a business owner, and mum as marketing director for a large corporate. Chloe talks candidly about dealing with the realisation that university was challenging, and how ego and arrogance made Chloe choose economics. But through perseverance and hard work, things started to look up, with Chloe starting a professional career in marketing at Sainsbury's, one of the large retailers in the UK, which after 5 years allowed Chloe to move to Australia to work for Coles, another large retailer in the country. I ask Chloe about three important topics, and we go deep into each, these being one, mental health and Chloe's own struggles with depression; two, how Chloe created a role for herself at Reckitt and built a team; and three, and perhaps the biggest moment of them all, making the decision to leave that steady job at Reckitt she was good at to try her hand at creating the coaching business called Pop, and how she made the transition. It's really an action-oriented conversation which summarizes Chloe well, and a lot of insights for each of us to apply to our lives. Chloe, welcome to the show. It's such a delight to have you on.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I feel honored to have been invited, so thank you.
No, I mean, we've spoken a number of times, and every time I speak to you, I'm like, I need to have Chloe on the show. She's got an interesting life journey and a lot of learnings. And you're the first guest from the UK, so I mean, that's always nice for us to broaden our horizons. So welcome early in the morning from the UK.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now, given the name of the show, is there a high flyer in your life that perhaps hasn't got the recognition to date?
I'm gonna shout out. I've got an amazing friend. She used to be my boss, and I think she saw something in me that before I even saw it in myself. I see so much gold and potential in her. She works at Reckitt. She's called Jess. And she's just a wonderful human. So I will shout out Jess.
Now, Chloe, if you zoom out and talk about your sunrise, as I call it, your childhood and your upbringing, what was that like? What are your memories of your environment and the influence of family growing up?
Yeah, I had a wonderful childhood, to be honest. I had a small family, but a very, very close one. I was very fortunate to spend a lot of time with my grandparents. So both my parents worked, and that basically meant that I spent a couple of days a week, including the nights, with my grandparents. And really, I think that was such a lovely experience. I think I was really, really fortunate. My dad's a business owner, so that has, and we'll come on to talk about what I'm doing now, but that has definitely had an influence, a big influence on me. And as well, my mum was European marketing director for Burger King, and she was, you know, a high flyer herself then. So I had always had kind of high achiever kind of style influences from an early age.
That so explains your ambition and drive now. It explains it very well. So that makes a whole lot of sense. And then how would your teachers describe you? Like, what was the young Chloe in high school and generally in society? Like, what were your passions and hobbies?
My teachers, I've always been incredibly conscientious. I was never at all the smartest person in school, but or in life. But I am incredibly hardworking. And I, to be honest, I probably was a bit annoying to my teachers. Like, if I've always known if I wanted to do something, then I'd sort of make it happen. I wanted to study economics at school, and they didn't offer it. And so I went to the school and said, I'm going to leave unless you offer economics. And somehow they did. They found a teacher to support that and added it to the curriculum. But I didn't necessarily love the teacher. I didn't. No offense to her, but I didn't think she wasn't teaching. Let's be frank. She wasn't teaching. So I basically decided that I was going to teach myself. So I went to the library and instead used that time to teach myself instead. So I think I was probably a bit annoying as a student, because I had very, very clear and high expectations of myself, as well as what learning meant and what I wanted learning to look like for me.
And I think that really captures your personality, being this go-getter where you kind of don't make excuses and you kind of get after it, right? In reflection, do you think that comes back to your parents or the environment you grew up in? Because it's always like it separates people, right? You see some people like who've had those kind of situations, but they have excuses where they blame it on the system or they blame it on the teachers, whereas you've chosen to take in yourself at a young age and go, you know what, I'm going to figure it out. Do you think there's somewhere that comes from? Like, there'd be a lot of listeners wondering, how is Chloe like this? Do you have any reflections on that?
So I don't think it necessarily came from my parents. My parents, if anything, told me to work less hard. They'd be like, Chloe, like, you've done enough homework for tonight, sort of thing. I don't know any different than always wanting to be the best that I could be. That wasn't necessarily the best. It was just I always wanted to challenge myself. I found all learning experiences actually quite difficult, because it doesn't necessarily come that naturally to me. But I've always had the mindset of, well, I'm not going to let this hold me back. I'm going to, you know, if it's difficult, how do I find a way to learn it or overcome it? Uni was really tough, really, really tough for me. I think I'd come from a really small school, and I sort of was like a big fish in a small pond, I suppose. There was probably only 50 people in my school before I left. It's not in my school, in my year. There was 50 people when I started the school, actually, but 50 in the year when I left. And when I moved to uni, it was incredible. I decided to study economics because, again, I wanted to challenge myself. And I was suddenly surrounded by such incredibly intelligent people. And it was a real, real challenge to come from having always done well and been really focused on academia and education and learning and valuing intelligence very highly to suddenly realizing, actually, I'm not intelligent at all comparative to people I was surrounded by.
I like how you're underplaying yourself, very, very much underplaying yourself. And tell me, I always like asking guests, I mean, did you have any heroes or any posters on the wall that when you were a kid you looked up to and you were like, oh, they're so inspiring, I'd love to be like them one day?
Posters, no. No, I can't think. I think probably my biggest inspiration, and he doesn't believe me when I say it, has always been my dad. But like outside of that, now I would do. I don't have posters around my wall, but now I have a huge number of people that I find incredibly inspiring. But back then, no, not so much.
And when you were 16, when you've got probably some sense of the world, right, and you've got some sense of who you are, what were your aspirations in life? Like, did you have a clear goal post high school or uni, or did you want to learn? Like, how did you approach that period where you're sort of figuring out the next phase of your life?
Yes, I did. I became very interested in developmental economics, and particularly around microfinance. Very geeky for a 16-year-old. But I was very lucky. I had an opportunity to do a kind of pre-uni internship at Goldman Sachs and in their economic research department. And I really, really was very passionate about the subject at the time. I always knew I wanted to make change in the world. And I thought it was around developing countries and really supporting those who have, I guess, high potential. If I look at it now and where that had come from, it's like there's so much opportunity there. It was how can I support that? And I thought economics would be the route and path that enabled me to make that change. But I found uni really difficult. I found the subject very difficult. So I shifted.
I think that's a really good point you mentioned, because a lot of listeners on the show that actually are university students or perhaps high school students and wanting to go to university, right? And I mean, you know this better than I do in today's world. There's a big kind of culture of, oh, we need to do it because our friends are doing it, or we need to do it because we need to be socially acceptable. Do you have any learnings from that period that you can share with listeners around how you, one, I think dealt with that difficult period, but then two, realized what you enjoyed through that?
Yeah, absolutely. So in hindsight, I was incredibly arrogant, and ego was driving the decision that I made around doing economics. I've always been passionate about business, particularly, you know, I shared that my dad's been a big influence, and I saw him as an entrepreneur having, you know, a couple of companies, and I was always interested in that. But business studies didn't have a particularly high rep, I suppose, at school, and so I thought, oh, I'll go with the harder option. When I started, I nearly quit in my first year. It was so difficult, and having gone from being kind of an A student to, I remember we had a maths kind of midterm test in my first year, and I had really studied for it, la la la. And I got 19%. Like, we're not talking about like not doing that well, like really, really, really poor. And that shook me completely, to like absolutely shattered my confidence and shattered my identity. And I felt really, really lost at that point in time. Didn't know what I wanted to do. What I think had been really really valuable for me was when I started to let go of what I thought I should be doing, and started to actually try. Like, we don't know until we try. So for me, the big saver had been I chose to do a placement as part of my university degree, so a year in industry, and I spent 14 months working at Sainsbury's. Sainsbury's in their marketing placement scheme, and it was such a side move, like it was such a rogue move comparative to everyone else that everyone in my cohort was doing, you know, finance. They'd gone into investment banking. They were doing their placements at, you know, in government or in economic, you know, in relevant areas to the subject. And I was like, no, you know what, I'm going to do marketing at a supermarket. And I am so glad I did, because although it seemed to have been completely left field, actually what I learned from that is, you know, you don't necessarily have to follow the path that's being paved for you, and also to get out of your own way in terms of not letting, you know, arrogance or money or any of those things drive the decisions around who you really are. I would have lots, and also it shaped me that the challenge that I had at uni has shaped me into knowing myself better. So I'm glad I didn't quit, because I ended up learning how resilient I was and how much really hard work can in the end pay off. I'm always loath to give advice, but that's been my experience.
I'm really glad you share that, because I think a lot of people would look at your exterior profile and assume that you've had success and you're confident and things have just worked out, right? And I think hearing that should give the listeners some inspiration that you can end up with 19%. I mean, I finished year 12 with 47% as my year 12 mark, and then life turned out okay. So I think often those things also teach you, like, to your point, teach you more than success would, because if you had success, probably that arrogance would have stayed. Whereas failure kicks out that arrogance very quickly.
Yeah, and it wasn't just one. It wasn't just one exam. My first year, I was the person, and most people in their first year and freshers are just really having a good time. I took it very seriously and spent a lot of time in the library, and I came out with 58%. And for someone who's never really had gone down below 70, to have their whole average, having put all of that effort in and really, you know, energy, I came out with 58, and then in my second year it came out with 62, and that was slightly better, but still nowhere near what I wanted to. And it wasn't until my third year I spent in industry and I learned work-life balance, and don't spend crazy hours. That's actually worse for your output if you're just living in the library. How on earth I ended up averaging over 70 for the entirety of the degree and coming out with a first. I have no idea how I managed it, but it showed me what I could do. If you really, really stick at it and try, and also try a different tack.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it reminds me of that quote that hard work, I think something around hard work doesn't work. I mean, talent doesn't work if hard work's not there, something along those lines. And I think that story sort of captures that pretty well. And I think the point you made around retail, I think we'll touch on that as part of your work. I think that's particularly important. I mean, I spent a number of years at Coles as well, and I think it's an industry that we don't appreciate as much in terms of a career path. And both of us have learned a lot out of it. I mean, you moved countries because of it as well. So that'll be something I'll be curious to get your thoughts on. And it's probably a good transition into magic moments, Chloe, which is something that I really like talking about on the show. What are some of those moments that have really been kind of an asterisk in your journey, whether it's in work or life? You've talked about some of the painful learnings. Is there a moment that stands out for you that you think played a pivotal role in your life, whether it was work or just life generally?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, the experience that everything changed for me was, if you're familiar with Simon Sinek's work, he talks about the concept of a why, and that every single person has a why that's innate to them, and that's what they look like at their natural best, and that's and so often, particularly around high achievers, we're seeking the what's, the next role, the next promotion, the, you know, that big challenge, etc. And for me, the game changer was finding my why. That has been the catalyst for everything else that has come since. And I had been doing a lot of personal deep work and reflections, and I'd been on loads of courses to try and understand who I was. But it wasn't until I worked with someone else to help uncover what that is. We can't see it for ourselves, that golden thread throughout our life that makes us who we are. So for me, my why is to spark change so that we're simply able to be our true selves. And the moment of that discovery was absolute magic, like not only the moment but everything else that built around it. And as a result of that has come part of my business that I've recently started, but also this real deep understanding of who I am and a confidence as well.
I wonder if you can talk more about that moment itself, because I mean the why is something that's very relevant in the COVID world we live in. And I mean, a lot of people are reflecting on their lives because you spend a lot of time in the retail industry, like you said. Was there a moment that led you to understanding that why, whether it was yourself or someone else who allowed that?
I think I've been building up to it for many years, but there is a process, a why discovery process that you can go through, which is from Simon Sinek. And I had got really interested in the concept of why, and did someone really have a why? You know, did we all have a why? And how can you put the essence of you into one sentence? So I decided to take a friend on that journey and try and find his why. And we did it, and it's a 3-hour process, which involves, similar to this, talking about stories from your past. And what a partner can do as part of that why discovery is to see the golden thread throughout the person whose why they're finding, see the golden thread throughout their life that makes them who they are, and put it into a kind of why statement. So a why statement looks like to contribution, so that impact. So for me, it's to spark change. That's the contribution that I make, so that we can simply be our true selves. That's the impact that I want to see in the world. That's the change I want to make. And so I did it with him, and it was magic. And then said, well, can you repay the favor? Can you find mine? And we did. We had an amazing kind of over an evening discovered it, and it was just... everything made sense after that. I think before that, another piece that had, like in that journey had been, I was at Coles, and I'd been experiencing periods of depression for a decade before that, so 10 years. And I decided it was Mental Health Awareness Week, which actually has just gone by here. But it was Mental Health Awareness Week. And I was in a really, really, really terrible place, and decided to tell people. I decided to share my story with others, with the hope that it helped others feel less alone in it. So that's probably another kind of moment, I suppose, that has shaped me into who I've become today, and was quite powerful.
I'm glad you shared that, because I think particularly, I mean, I worked at Coles for a number of years, and I'm sure we can talk about this to an extent around the culture in a company like that, which is, for listeners wondering, it's a huge supermarket chain here in Australia, a retail company here in Australia, and it's a very fast-paced culture where you kind of sink or swim. I mean, I'd be curious, when you kind of realized that you were going through that and you sort of acknowledged it in your own mind, how did you feel comfortable dealing with it and speaking about it? Because I think there's a lot of listeners out there who might be in a similar phase, but they're paranoid about speaking to their manager or speaking to their colleagues because they're fearful of the judgment they'll get or the response they would get. And I mean, you're a coach now, which we'll go into in a bit, but do you have any pointers from your own experience to share with them where they can feel comfortable sharing and they don't feel any kind of pushback on their career?
I think all of this is very much a personal journey. I it, the depression that I experienced started around uni, around kind of that kind of realizing I wasn't as intelligent as I hoped I was. It probably started back then. And so I had been experiencing it for a very long time before then, and people probably wouldn't have known that that was what was going on. I do remember when I was at Sainsbury's, so before I joined Coles back in the UK, I shared what I was going through with HR. Actually, as part of a kind of grad panel, I decided, I think we were asked to share our biggest achievement or something from our graduate scheme, what we'd learned. And rather than kind of share, you know, one of the kind of big projects and, you know, big successes that have come out of one of the projects I've been working on, I decided I was going to share my experience of kind of overcoming stress and anxiety, or like dealing and how I managed that. And I guess it was not handled very well. The HR person who had been there just decided to try and take categories off me.
Oh, wow.
I'm sure her intentions were good in terms of, you know, wanting to support, but I didn't want any work. I was sharing it as a positive experience, or attempting to, rather than, you know, being like, save me from this experience that I'm having. So I guess why I share that is because that was what people probably fear most about sharing their experience, so that they don't want to be judged or treated differently. Or certainly I didn't want to be judged or treated differently. I don't want anyone to think less of me. I didn't want anyone to think I was less capable. And so I'd had that experience. And so for me, it was quite risky. It felt risky sharing when I was at Coles what I was going through. But I sort of moved past it, was like, you know what? People can't help you unless you tell them how that's going to, like, tell them what support looks like for you. So support through my mental health challenges looks different to other people. And I think where one of my biggest learnings was around really understanding and getting clear on what helps me, what from my menu of options, like yoga or meditation or journaling or working from home. I've got loads of things and tools that can in my toolkit now, that if I'm feeling like I'm close to kind of what I call the dark place, then I'm like, okay, hang on, get my tools out, my toolkit, and I'm gonna make sure that I set myself up to manage this. And what had really helped was sharing that with a line manager and saying, look, I'm not sharing this because I want you to do anything specific, but this is what I experience, this is how I manage it, and this is what support looks like for how you can help me if I'm ever nearing a period. And I think when you approach it in that way, I've certainly only ever had people respond really, really well to that, because they know then how to help. So I had a line manager at Coles where I'd said, look, if this happens, then I need to do a work from home day. It's funny now, we've gone from working home much more regularly, but I need to do a work from home day maybe once every 2 weeks just to help me reset. And he was amazing and said, why just once every 2 weeks? Whenever you need it, I am empowering you to go and do that. But he wouldn't have been able to do that if I hadn't have told him what I needed. And so I think it's really, really added value sharing it and talking about it. But also, I'm of the belief that if the company doesn't deserve me, if they're going to treat me in a way that they're not going to accept me as the wholeness of myself, including any challenge that I'm going through around my mental health. So, I'm of the view of, if I share my own experience, disregarding the fear of what others might think, and that helps one other person feel less alone in their journey, or in their journey of experiencing or supporting someone else through it, then that's worth it for me.
Mm. Yeah, no, super actionable insights that hopefully someone listening, if they're going through something similar, can take some pointers from that. Now, I'm sure listeners are wondering, they're thinking, Chloe mentioned the UK, she's gone to Coles in Australia. How did that happen? And I mean, that's probably a magic moment in itself, where you moved from the UK to Australia. Mm. And then I think you'd been at Sainsbury's for about 5 years, and then you chose, I would imagine, to move. Can you share that? What led you to want to move, and why Australia?
Yeah. I hadn't actually ever been to Australia. I hadn't thought about it. Coles had reached out to see whether I was interested in it. I'd said no. And a couple of years later, they then got back in touch and said, are you interested now? And
yeah, Coles had a habit of doing that, didn't they?
And I guess I was like, well, why not? Like, what, why not? And people say, you know, oh, you were so courageous to go across the other side of the world on your own. And I guess I was, to a certain degree. I didn't know anyone over there. I'd never been, but I had the view of, well, if it doesn't work, I'll just come back, you know. Mm. And I'd never planned to go over for a long, long period of time. I thought it'd be a year or two at max. But it was amazing. I think I was talking to someone yesterday actually about, often when you leave a company, we're all growing, right? We're all growing in our own experience. You know, if I look at myself even three months ago, I've grown from that period. Often when you're in a company for a long period of time, you grow, but you still have those old kind of senses of those old identities, those old beliefs, and actually having shifted. And when leaving Sainsbury's was amazing for me, because it sort of empowered me to step into that bigger version of myself that I had been growing into. I think of it as a bit of like a snake shedding off their layers. Like, the old skin was sort of hanging around, and when I moved across the other side of the world and into a new company, I was able to be the shiny version of the snake. Snake's probably not a great idea, but and it's the same when I left Coles and moved to Reckitt. I have had that same experience, as well as when I left Reckitt to start my own thing. It's just this constant evolution, and shifting and moving companies for me was really, really helpful version. Even teams and roles can help you do that, but shedding the skin.
And I'm always curious on that. I think particularly yourself with your personality, I'm sure you go into a role or a company or any venture with some sort of a plan in your mind, right? How do you think that's changed over the years? Like, when you went from Sainsbury's to Coles, Coles to Reckitt, and like you said, even within the company when you move roles, like, what were some of your pointers when you'd go into a new role that you had kind of top of mind that you wanted to achieve, either through relationships or through objectives? That's evolved over the years. Have you learned now your sweet spot, that when you go into a new environment or a new role, you sort of know what questions to ask and how to deal with it?
I'm naturally, like, if you're familiar with kind of Gallup's strength finders and the different strengths, like, most of my strengths are all in the kind of analytical, strategic zone. So I have tended to lean on those when I first move into a role, and very quickly get to grips with, okay, what's the challenge here? What's the real problem? And what's a kind of meaningful strategy in order to overcome that? So I think that's been my natural tendency. And then what's been able to build around it is, okay, well, so how else can I add value? For me, the question I always ask is, how can I add more value than anyone else? Not necessarily in a competitive sense, but just how can I add value? Because people respond to that. Businesses, anyone responds to that. Customers, clients, companies, bosses respond to it. If you're solving problems for other people, then they're gonna wanna have you around. So it's always been truly trying to understand, okay, well, actually, what's my boss's real challenge here, and how can I play a part in solving that? Or what's the business challenge here? Or what's the category challenge here? Or what's the customer challenge here? How can we go about adding more value into that equation? So that's generally how I've approached it.
And then the other side of that would probably be, particularly, I mean, when you're working in companies like Coles and Sainsbury's, I know from my time, often their portfolio managing is millions of dollars worth, right? And you've got a huge role to play in terms of the food people eat or the products people consume. And there probably would be days where you're overwhelmed. You're just either worried or you're overwhelmed. You've had a bad week with sales. How did you deal with those moments? Because, I mean, I think a lot of people go through that in everyday life, but I think we don't appreciate how kind of stressful retail is, because it's so day to day. And yesterday's sales don't mean much today, and you've got a range review coming up and you've got changes. And then you talked about your Coles experience, where you went through a period where you were kind of worried, right? And you spoke about it. Yeah. Have there been any other moments where you've been overwhelmed, whether it's a project or a team you're working with, and you had to kind of deal with it? Did you have any learnings there?
Yeah, absolutely. My first 6 months at Coles, for anyone who was part of that, were really tough. I cried, I think, almost every day, and I was working, enormous hours and weekends. And I think I thought that just throwing and working and doing more and more and more and more, I'd eventually get through a to-do list. And I think the reality is that would never have happened. And what really helped me, and what Coles taught me, or what that experience taught me, was actually understanding myself and what works for me in terms of what is those, I talked about it before, but we'll mention it, the menu of options that I have around wellbeing practices that are really gonna work for me. And I got really interested in exploring loads of things to see, okay, well, what's the one? And I think, if I'm honest, I was probably looking for what's the one thing that I can have in my arsenal that's going to solve this period of anxiety or stress and going to help me through. And what I learned was, actually, it's not one. It's a combination of tools, be it go for a walk or for me, journaling has been really, really helpful. So has yoga. Yoga, I say yoga saved my life, and it probably did. And I practiced yoga for the last 10 years, and it's amazing, and it's always there. And that practice has grown as I have. But I would never say to someone else, do yoga, and that's going to solve your stress and anxiety issues. Because it's going to, for my sister, it's go for a run. She loves, she needs to go to the gym in the morning first thing and do that. That helps her. And so we all look so different. And I think that's what's interesting about us as individuals is, well, how can you try different things out and get a sense of, okay, what's going to work for you? And then put it first. Like, we put work before everything else so often at the end of the day, though. And I think maybe COVID's, the pandemic has taught us this, like, if you've not got your health, you've not got anything. And so I started to learn that my mental health was my number one priority. And therefore, the most important decision of my day was how was I going to support that, particularly if I was in a period, as you say, stress, or, you know, a stressful period, or I was not feeling great. Like, how do I support myself then? But also, how do you support yourself when you're in periods of where everything feels like it is okay, so that it's not suddenly you flick a switch back to, oh, I'm in reaction mode. It's more around, oh no, proactively, I've been, you know, I've got these habits that are in place that are supporting me for when I need.
And I think another moment that I'd be curious about is when you joined RB, you talked about Reckitt. For listeners who might not be familiar, Reckitt's got powerhouse brands, right? Like Dettol and Strepsils, and one of the biggest sort of consumer goods companies. And I know during your period there, you sort of created a role for yourself. And you found an opportunity, and you became, I think, head of category strategy. Probably a two-part question there. I think one is, in an environment like Reckitt, a global company with a lot of process, structure, risk-averse, how do you make the business feel comfortable there? And, I mean, influencing the big part of that, so I wonder if there's any reflections there on how you manage to influence. Yeah. And then two, I think you built a team as well as part of that, and you found people to support your vision. How did you do that? Because you took a huge risk as well, because you said, give me a chance and I'll prove to you this is worth doing right. And that's a massive risk that a lot of people would kind of be fearful of. So I wonder if you can share some kind of color to that, one around the influencing part, and then two, how do you build a team?
Yeah, absolutely. When I joined Reckitt, I joined into an existing role, which was a customer strategy manager role. And I did so because I thought it was going to really meet my strengths, and it did. And it was really, I really enjoyed it. But then I was looking to, how do I challenge myself next? And I thought, I really want, you know, take a kind of leadership position, because I know I can add value. But I didn't actually want to do any of the roles that I could see, available. I didn't want to do them. And so I basically had a choice. I thought I had a choice of, I could sort of not force myself into doing a role that I don't necessarily think is going to be right, or I can ask the question. There's a Mahatma Gandhi quote that I really love, which is, if you don't ask, you don't get. And I'm a big believer in actually understanding what does the business need, or what does your boss want, or what's going to support the business outcomes, and then strategically thinking, how can that fit into what I want to do, and trying to find that win-win. You know, buying is all about finding a win-win. And Reckitt at the time didn't have a category strategy team, and they existed in, you know, I'd worked by a side, that'd been I'd had amazing experiences with other companies like P&G, etc., who had these amazing category teams. And I thought, this would add so much value to our customer relationships if we had one, if Reckitt had one. And so basically did a lot of research, understanding, what does that look like in the market? How do category teams exist? How are they structured? How are they also structured in Reckitt, because it's a global company? How are they structured in, let's say, the UK as an example? What exists there? And they have the team in the UK. So I came back with a pitch to my boss at the time, who's now the GM, to say, this is what I think should exist. This is the value that I think it's going to add to the business. And, oh, by the way, I'd love to lead that team. It felt very bold at the time, but really, really exciting.
And you did that role, I think, for about a year and a half, and then you decided to pack up. And then obviously you've got a new exciting venture now. Now, before we get to your new venture and the work you're doing there, I think that moment in itself is a big, big moment, right? Because I've had a number of guests on the show who've talked about that moment when there's a sort of inflection point where you go, okay, I'm ready to make this jump, or something kind of triggers in your own mind that leads you to make the jump. And you didn't just make the jump, you also moved back to the UK. And then I remember we caught up before you moved back. I wonder if you could share kind of what some of your thoughts in your mind that led you to go, okay, I'm going to go full time into this venture, and I'm going to go ahead first and try it out. Like, What was that period like, and what kind of led you to it?
I mentioned my dad at the beginning. He started his own business, subsequently bought a business, and now has for 30 years had, you know, run successful businesses with big teams. So I'd sort of grown up seeing that it was possible, but also having a real understanding for what it meant to own your own business and just how much effort and energy it takes, and that you're sort of always on, or certainly my dad has always been on, and he is so passionate. He's in the toy industry. He is so passionate about toys, and I saw that's what it took in order to have a successful business for a long period of time. You really have to be passionate about what you're choosing to do. So whilst I had always had it in the back of my mind that I'd love to see if I could start my own business and do something and challenge myself in that way, I never could see anything that I was passionate about enough to do. And I spoke about finding my why. That really was the catalyst for everything else that followed, because I found it, and at the same time I'd been reading a book or working through a book called The Artist Way by Julia Cameron, and it involved some kind of morning pages. You do journaling in the morning. And I remember being out, Tom, my partner, and I had been away we just got out into nature and we were sort of camping. And I remember the idea just for the business just hit me. People talk about that. And I remember reading Elizabeth Gilbert talks about it in Big Magic around this kind of ideas having life, and that literally felt like the moment. It suddenly hit me, and I basically spent the next kind of 3 days building and just pen to paper, like manically writing and creating and dreaming around what this thing was going to be. This is long term and so big and so exciting, and I suddenly understood, oh, this is passion. Like, this is my passion. Like, and it came from having done a lot of work around really trying to understand, okay, well, what's my why and what's my vision for the world that I want to see, what's, you know, what could be a mission. And then the idea hit for how do I bring that to life. And yeah, it was magic, genuinely magic. And so then I then had a sort of double life, I suppose. I'd work at Reckitt during the day, you know, the 9 to 5 or whatever the hours look like, and I'd give that my all because that's who I am. And then as soon as I, you know, even at the start of the day, I'd be working on my side hustle at the time, and then at the end of the day I'd be working on my side hustle, and then my weekends I'd be working on my side hustle. And I was so passionate about it, but it just became to a point where it wasn't sustainable, like to be on for all that time. And like I mentioned earlier around kind of you don't ask, you don't get. I did go to Reckitt and say, look, this is what I'm doing. And they were super supportive. And I said, I need to get some balance back in my life somehow. And I went and put forward an idea of, well, go down to 4 days a week. I'd seen kind of parents and carers do it. And I thought, well, you know, my side business is a bit like my baby. Why couldn't it be true that, that I create, you know, a day a week where I could work solidly on that, and then I'd get one of my days, my weekend back. And I did that, and they were amazing, and they supported that. But just the more I worked on it, the more I was like, I want to give this my full attention, because I have a vision for how much change I want to see in the world, and POP is all around helping helping people dive into their own potential, and I am so excited to support leaders and support. Well, my vision is to empower millions to dive into the pool of potential within themselves, like, and I, so that they're able to make their unique difference in the world. And I realized that throughout my life, I've had so many causes that I was interested in. Like, you know, we talked about microfinance right at the beginning. Like, I wanted to go and, you know, help microfinance in developing countries. I wanted to smash the stigma around mental health. I want to, you know, the world to be kind of more sustainable. There's so many passionate areas that I have, but I can't make a difference in every one of those. But I can help others who are purpose-led leaders make that change. And so that's my mission now, is to support leaders to make the change that they want to see in the world around what is in what most interests them, because then they're going to be able to, you know, deliver that sustainably. So
sounds super, yeah, exactly, super exciting. And you're doing it full time for, I think, three or four months now, and then it's going well from what I understand. So I think one of the questions before we actually talk about POP a little bit is, a number of guests that have come on the show who've done something similar to yourself often talk about the limitation is the financial element, because if you have a job that kind of sustains your lifestyle, and then you can kind of focus on your passion in the evening, right? And I know we've spoken about this a little bit off record. I wonder if you can share some learnings there with the listeners, because I know speaking to people in different facets, that's a massive barrier where people are like, oh, if I quit this and go full time, do I need to have 12 months of a safety net, or do I need to find investors and get funding or get family and friends support me? Yeah. Did you put together a plan for the first couple of months going, this is the worst case scenario, this is what I can secure in terms of sales revenue? How did you sort of navigate through that, if you can share one or two learnings?
Well, all of the literature, a lot of the literature and experience says do it for as long as you can do as a side hustle. Like, you know, because you've got that security, there isn't a scarcity mindset, you're not, you know, you don't suddenly feel like you have to, you know, it changes. Scarcity mindset isn't really, like, our mind is the most powerful tool that we have. So it really is a thing. And going from, you know, a very, very good salary, and that security net is a huge risk. And it does feel scary. And I would never say to anyone else that that they should go all in. But for me, going all in has meant I will find a way of making this work. Like, I will. And I quote, and I'm not going to do it justice, but something along the lines of, change doesn't happen from an empty belly. Like, a full belly. Like, you need an empty belly in order to really make change. And that really is what it feels like. I've gone cold turkey, I suppose. And so there is a different level of conviction that I have to making sure that it works. So in terms of financial plan, yes, have a financial plan. I mean, my background in terms of buying definitely definitely is supporting me there. But it's iterating, and what I'm learning, what I've learned, my biggest learnings in the first 4 weeks, well, not 4 weeks, 4 months, is to test and learn. Like, what is currently the iteration, or what I'm doing with POP now might end up kind of doing that longer and beyond, but I'm learning from every single thing that I do, and it's just about testing and learning. And if you're waiting to be ready, as I was for many years for in so many aspects of my life, you never I was never going to be fully ready, because despite how strategic I am, a plan on a page is just a plan on a page until you actually get feedback on it, as in not someone saying that they would be interested in buying that product, but people actually buying that product or changing their behavior in some sort of way. You don't see it until you try it. So yeah, it's scary for sure, but a lot of fun.
Oh, I'm sure. And I think it reminds me of something that's very commonly spoken about in the startup world, is that if you believe in the idea, why aren't you doing it full time? Right. And I think you're showing that you believe in it. That's why you're doing it full time. Whereas if someone's doing it for 5 hours a week and they've got all their safety net secured through their day job, they probably don't believe in it enough. So I think you've sort of captured that really well. Now, Chloe, we talk about your hustle and go deep into it and touch particularly on Pop. How would you describe the business and where it's at, and particularly your role in the business for listeners wondering?
My role in the moment is everything. Founder, CEO, marketing specialist. I'm building a team, which is really exciting, and the next iteration. And as I say, if I'm going to achieve my goal of empowering millions to dive into the pool of potential within themselves, then I can't just do it alone. So this will, it will grow and iterate. Really, it comes out of spotting a gap in terms of, in the corporate world, I see, there's a lot of courses around professional development, but often, and you'll know from courses you'll have been on, but those workbook, you go on the thing, the training, the event, and that workbook gets shoved in a drawer. And despite the best intentions that we have in order to apply what we've learned, if you're not supported in a way, and you're not held accountable, and then you don't necessarily take the action. And there is, despite loving learning, there is a difference between cognitive understanding and applied knowing, applied learning. So for me, it's around providing professional development that lasts, and that's providing an alternate solution. So one that's accessible, rather than just for those who have been identified as high potentials or whatever. Often they are the only people who are offered these opportunities to go on these courses. So accessible, lasting, rather than it gets shoved in a book, that you actually put it, apply it, and tailored, that it's right for you, that you need, right for the individual in what they need there, and they're able to apply it. And so, yeah, Pop, we're building that through the power of community and accountability there, also coaching, which enables that tailoring piece, as well as challenge and application and accountability, as well as the expertise, which is important, the knowledge, the know-how, that is absolutely has a role, and the mentors, etc. But it's around how do you integrating those three to provide that alternate solution to provide professional development that lasts.
And I'd encourage all listeners to check out Chloe's Instagram page or LinkedIn. I mean, I think you post almost every day from what I've noticed, and there's a lot of cool content there and some very visual graphics that you share with some nice colorful images. Probably the other question there, Chloe, is what do you think you need to do in the next, say, 2 years that's going to help you separate yourself from the pack in the coaching world? I mean, I've been fortunate to have a few guests on the show who do coaching in different aspects, and they've spoken about how competitive it is today, and then you've touched on it, there's a gap in the market. Is there a couple of things you've observed in your early days that you think you need to do more of to separate yourself from the crowd, or something the listeners can help you with?
Yeah, so for me, where Pop is kind of different is around creating this community, community accountability and community support, as well as the coaching, as well as the expertise. And so in terms of what I need to do differently, my intention is never, like, coaching is still a fairly untapped in its infancy. So I believe that we can all more than survive, we can thrive together. And actually my long-term goal for Pop is not for me to do the coaching, it's actually to have a team of coaches that are supporting the community, and we are all in it together in terms of growing. And my focus is on leaders because I believe in the ripple effect that leaders can have on the communities and the teams that they are surrounded by. And if we want to empower that them to make the change that they want to see and be an inspiration for others, that's where I think that's where the difference we can make. I get asked so many times, who is your biggest competitor or who are your competitors? And I'm like, you know what? There's room for everyone, I believe. And more people engaging in coaching and taking it on and getting a coach completely transformed my life. So I would never want to hold any coaches back from becoming a coach. The industry is only going to grow in my belief, but in the future, if there are coaches listening to this in, you know, a year's time or whatever, when I'm looking for those to support the team, reach out, because that's the extent of what we will build. And if there's also listeners who are like, what are you talking about in terms of coaching? It is transformational. A coach is not a mentor. A coach is all around asking powerful questions that enable you to access insight within yourself. And a coach believes that you have everything that you need within you. You just need support to be able to see what you can't see and access that through the power of questions. And it's transformational, and I love it.
It reminds me of something I was listening to yesterday where they were talking about in the sporting world, if an athlete doesn't have a coach, we would wonder what they're doing with themselves, right? Whereas in the business world, you only see, like, to your point, you only see coaches for corporate CEOs or senior executives, but the rest of the business don't have any guidance as such. So it's kind of fascinating how that ulterior world exists compared to sports, where a lot of the nuance is the same, but they all have coaches and they're actually more skilled than we are. You look at a professional tennis player or cricket player, they don't need to be told what to do. They just need that mental support and that kind of idea, someone they can bounce off. So
Absolutely. Pop is the support crew for leaders, essentially. Just as elite athletes, as you say, have a team around them supporting them to be at their best. And who, when they're on the podium, do they thank? They thank the team around them for empowering them and enabling them to get there. Whereas leaders so often feel like that they should be going it alone. Whereas actually, who are your coaches? Who are your mentors? Who are your cheerleaders? Who are your team? Like who are your peers? And getting really clear on who are those four components and building as strong as possible team around you that that empowers you. That's what's missing. That's the gap, I think, and that's what we want to support.
Yeah, I can't wait. I'm excited to see you pop. And I like the word pop. I hope it pops. Now time for the final sprint, Chloe, where I'll ask a couple of questions and if you can give me a 60-second answers. Is there one investment you've made that you consider the best in your life? And it doesn't have to be financial.
Oh, it is coaching. Been, I mean, I've had a coach for the last 3 years. I don't think I'll ever not have a coach anymore. You can't see what you can't see. And my coach, who I speak to every 10 days, 2 weeks, like 14 to 10 days, every time I'm like, oh, what are we going to talk about? Like, as in, how do I push myself even more? Like, how do I expand to the next level? And we have just had such massive exponential growth, and I definitely owe a huge amount of my mindset shift to her. I think Warren Buffett talks about, you know, the best investment anyone can ever make in their life is in themselves. That's my belief and experience.
One thing you want to learn in the next 6 months?
Ooh, what do I want to learn? I'm pausing because I love to learn. Like, I'm learning so much at the moment. What do I want to learn?
Is there something you're going really deep on that you're like, I want to pick this up for the business or for your own development?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always looking to expand as a coach, but really the technical stuff at the moment is really interesting, like web development, that sort of thing has been fun, and there's just so much of that that I want to grow in too. The biggest thing for me in the next year plus is how do I build a team, and how, I guess, learning. I've managed teams obviously in the past, but there's a big difference between paying for the team yourself and having the guts to really invest into the future on the basis of where it's the vision of where the business is going to go. So yeah, how do you do that is definitely something I'm learning.
Is there one source that you use for your information that you read every day or you listen to every day?
No, I'm a big reader. I'll shout out, there's an amazing podcast and friend called Steph's Business Bookshelf, I think. And she, the concept is that she does the reading for you. So I'll often listen to Steph's recommendations of the books that she's read to see whether or not that's worth the time investment to go before I go and read it myself. So I use that, but many, many different tools.
And last one, is there one thing you do every week to get the best out of yourself mentally and physically?
Reflection, so journaling. Usually daily, but also I'll do a weekly kind of reflection, what's happened in the week, what am I celebrating. I believe celebrations is a muscle. To celebrate is a muscle that we must flex, so I'll spend a bit of time reflecting on what am I celebrating for the week. And I do this with all my clients as well. We start every single call with what are we celebrating. I think also the higher you go up in business, the less people there are telling you that you're doing a great job. So the earlier in life you can learn that skill, the better.
Celebration is a muscle. That's a good note to end on, Chloe. That's the finish line. So thank you so much for joining me. And you've shared very candidly about some of your painful moments, but also your experiences, and super excited about POP and where it goes in the future, and looking forward to being involved.
Thank you so much for having me. And hopefully it was helpful.
I hope you took away some actionable insights and learnings from this conversation to apply to your lives and be 1% better every day. And I look forward to sharing the next episode with you next Tuesday. Stay tuned.